Embracing our shadow is important because if we understand ourselves at that level, then we can find acceptance within ourselves and the broader world around us.
Welcome into the expansive world of cis society, a space where taboos dissolve, shadows become allies, and sensuality, intimacy, and sexuality are celebrated as gateways to truth. This is Taboo Talks, a podcast where no topic is off limits, and everything is held with courage, compassion, and curiosity. Together, let's shatter the limits of what we've been taught to fear and transform it into the power to live fully, freely, and authentically. Welcome back to Taboo Talks. Today, we are welcoming an extraordinary guest who brings courage, intellect, and a deep sense of curiosity to some of the most taboo and complex corners of human sexuality. Dr. Victoria Hartman holds two doctorate degrees, including a PhD in human sexuality with a specialization in clinical sexology and a master's in public health. Her expertise spans forensic sexology, the psychological study of death fetishes, and the preservation of erotic history. She is also the director of the Erotic Heritage Museum in Las Vegas. It's awesome, by the way. Check it out. An expert valuator of explicit materials and a published author of I Love Dead People, Inside the Minds of Death Fetishists and the Sexual Art of Serial Killers. She also serves on the advisory board of the Advanced Space Life Research Institute. Dr. Hartman's work pushes boundaries and asks bold questions, examining the erotic psyche, archiving sexually explicit films, and investigating the impact of violent content on the human mind. She's a rare voice, merging academic rigor, psychological insight, and fearless storytelling. We are so excited to have you on the show. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely, it's an honor. We're really amped to have this conversation. We have a taboo podcast, and I feel like this may be one of the most taboo subjects that we're going to dive into. So yeah, we're on the edge of our seat here, and yeah, we just want to go right in. I'm curious what originally sparked your curiosity to explore necrophilia, murders, and super taboo realms of sexuality.
Thank you so much for that question. I actually get that quite a bit because it's more common to see men and male identified people pursuing academic inquiry of this nature. Most of my colleagues are male. And so for me, the original, well, let me start earlier than in my 20s, actually, or my teens. I grew up in a very interesting household with an American father and a German mother who were complete at odds in terms of how they taught sexuality or how they talked about sexuality.
Okay.
My mother was she discussed things openly.
I could ask her any questions that didn't
garner any kind of a negative response.
That
parent, whereas my father was very repressed and my mother tells a story that by the time I was 3 or 4, he no longer took me into the shower because of embarrassment and shame. Even though at the age of 4 or 3, I'm not going to really understand, you know, the difference between my parents or my parents. It doesn't really matter. And my mother had such an open relationship or a comfortable relationship with sexuality and nudity. So I credit a lot of my fearlessness to the way she brought me up around sex, especially later on when they divorced, we moved over to Europe and I came of age in Germany where, you know, human sexuality is, it's a non-issue. It's not even that it's not an issue or that it's minimized or that it's looked at differently. It's just a non-issue. It's like anything else, biology, human relations. So, you know, I grew up in that kind of an environment over there. And, but what I understand now to be the genesis of the work that I'm pursuing is my own trauma. I was the victim of a gang rape at the age of 16, and I was actually lucky I survived. There was one other girl who was a couple of years older than me. She did not. And after a rather dysfunctional way of coping, which was through addiction, when I got sober almost 30 years ago now, the first thing I wanted to do was go to college. I had grown up with luckily my American family was very, very academic, and I was a little late to the game, but I got back into college and or went to college actually in my late 20s, and the first class that I took was Psych 101. And when we got to the deviant behavior chapter, it was like lightning. It hit me, and that's kind of just it took me with it. And I never lost interest. I obsessed on that topic. I continue to obsess on that topic. And it's led me to where I'm at. I followed it relentlessly. I was not going to let anything get in the way of that. And that's how I ended up here as an author who now researches that with some of the most brilliant minds I could have ever hoped to. I mean, they, I mean, I worship them. Like, I'm getting ready to do a research project with Dr. David Wall that I can't discuss because of how subversive it is. And also, it represents some danger to the both of us. So until we manage to get through that research and publish our findings, I can't talk about it. But one of the things that has remained with me is this: maybe I'm not fearful enough of the world around me. Maybe I should be a little bit more fearful. And I ask myself often if survivors have a higher tolerance for risk taking than, say, perhaps the general population. I don't know. I haven't actually looked into that, but I do attribute my experience with kind of this logic in my head that I've survived the worst. What else could, is there anything else to be afraid of? So, that's why I do the work that I do, because ultimately, if I can find even a shred of something that gives law enforcement or psychologists the ability to see this coming before it happens, then perhaps I could spare one life, just one. So that's why I do the work that I do. And the museum was sort of an aside, but luckily, as a privately held museum, the gentleman who owns it, he places no restrictions on me to be able to pursue this passion of mine. So I'm lucky that I found where, where I'm at now, and that I found the owner of the museum, and that we get along as well as we do. You could say he's a little bit of a shadow gentleman himself, even though now at 81 he's mellowed out quite a bit.
Love that. He's mellowed out at 81. Well, thank you. Thank you for your vulnerability and sharing what brought you to where you are now. You know, I hear this shame growing up with your father, right? There was this cocktail of shame, and then you were a survivor of something really traumatic. And then that led you to the door of curiosity, where you began to kind of peel back the layers and say, like, what is here? What is this about? How can I transmute it? How can I serve the world with it? And I also feel, yeah, I feel really inspired. I feel really inspired by your story and how the journey through the shadow leads to some sort of sliver of light, right? Or information that can support someone else who's also met that same sliver. And so I see you as an advocate for people that have also survived something really intense, you know, saying like, hey, I've made it through. And I'm leaning into it. Like, I'm not repressing it. I'm not disassociating. Like, I'm fucking facing it head on. And yeah, I find your work really moving. And so
Thank you.
I wanted to thank you for it, for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, deep.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like so much gratitude as well. And it just is really so interesting how, if you believe in this thing, like we choose our destinies, and we in this like other consciousness realm, like that the things that are our biggest obstacles and our biggest barriers and our biggest wounds end up being what guides us to into our dharma, into our purpose. and the healing that we're supposed to bring into the world. And so, yeah, it's just so incredible to see how you've alchemized all that pain and how you are really turning it into art and beauty and education and information for, I think, probably saving more than just one life. But even if you could just save that one life, like that your friend that lost their life, that's just such a beautiful mission. So yeah, thank you for doing that. And thank you for sharing about yourself so personally. It invites even more honesty into this conversation. So we're really excited to dive even deeper into the darkness with you. But before we do that, we're just going to take a quick message from our affiliates, and then we'll be right back.
Hey, Hot Stuff. We're going to take a quick pause from the show just because I'm so excited to tell you guys about one of the most transformative online tools that I've used that has really unlocked my pleasure journey to the next level. And that is the OMGS course. So until this last year, I actually struggled to orgasm on my own without the help of a toy. I felt dependent, I felt hopeless, and I honestly felt like there was something wrong with me. But within just 2 weeks of starting this course, I had my first orgasm from my own touch, and I was like, hallelujah, I'm not broken. And it's just opened up so much since then. I can honestly say it's just gotten better and wetter from there. So OMGS course is a fun, user-friendly course packed with all sorts of different videos and techniques and showcases a myriad of different women. And it will completely shift the way that you experience pleasure. So whether you're struggling with orgasms or maybe you just want to amplify your pleasure, both solo and with a partner, this course is truly a game changer. You can use the link in our show notes below to unlock your orgiastic potential and also to support the expansion of the cis society movement. Now back to your show.
Talks. We're here with the beautiful, inspirational Dr. Victoria Hartman, exploring the darkest edges of sexuality, death, and the human psyche. So, as we continue this conversation, I really want to get more into the juice of really what it is that you study. And so, will you tell us a little bit more about what is necrophilia and what has studying it and anything else that you've been studying around that taught you about human sexuality?
Thank you so much for that question. It's my answer would be is that it's multifaceted. Okay. So let me come from the researcher's angle first. Once I got my degrees and I actually started to really, well, I started diving into the classification systems around necrophilia during my doctoral work. And I had had about 20 years of exposure to online communities of people who identify as necrophiliacs who felt these inclinations starting in their teens. And it wasn't until the advent of the internet in the 90s, where people could access it more easily, that they found each other. And up until that point, these folks had lived in fear that they were monsters and that they were going to commit violent acts against others, which they found abhorrent, which surprised me in the research that I did, because I had this idea that if you're inclined this way, of course you're going to act out like a BTK or a Richard Ramirez or a Jeffrey Dahmer or what have you. And I found that there was this whole community of people online who, for whom this was merely a fantasy and a kink, and they never wanted to actually hurt anyone at all.
And
Which kind of,
necrophilia is the, do you
so
mind just like,
necrophilia is the desire to be sexually close to a deceased person. Okay. But it's so multifaceted that I don't even know that that's an adequate description. That's just a description in academic books. So let me preface with that. So what I found in the classification systems was disagreement between the different categories. One of the research groups, they found one of the first papers that was done by Rosman and Resnick, they found three different types of necrophiliacs. Pseudonecrophiliacs, actual necrophiliacs, and then a third I can't think of right now. So some that fantasized about it, some that actually did it, and then a third, like I said, I don't recall off the top of my head. And then later on there was Anil Agrawal, and he defined 10 systems or 10 classifications. But they just seemed all disjointed, especially given the people that I had interviewed in my work, and they didn't make sequential sense. Some of the more severe forms of necrophilia were higher up on the scale and less severe than the ones that were maybe just fantasy or where people could only function through fantasy. It just seemed very bizarre. And that's, why I started my response this way is because necrophilia, even though its definition is sex with dead people, that's not what these different categories are bearing out. There's all these gray areas that go from just fantasy all the way to violent murder for the purpose of acquiring a body for for sex. So, I wanted to challenge that because the ones that the classification systems that are out there, they just don't make any sense. So I proposed my own, and there's another researcher, Lee Mellor. He's proposed three of his own. So there's myself and at least one other researcher who are challenging the current classification system. So that's one angle of necrophilia. The other is that there seem to be distinctions between those who fetishize it and those who act out on it, where there's a large section who don't act out on it at all. And those are the folks you're going to find in these online communities for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part. And then you have those, of course, who are likely incarcerated or are going to end up incarcerated who aren't going to be satisfied through fantasy. And then there's a third category or a third part to this, which I just recently found when I was writing my second book, The Sexual Art is Fear of Serial Killers, because in the work that I did, there seemed to be a big chasm between the people who act out and the people who fetishize it and don't want to act out. In other words, yeah, they want a consenting partner, they can play around with fantasies, but they don't want to hurt anybody. And I had proposed a definition called progressive paraphilia because I wanted to be a big shot and on the cover of Time magazine as the person who found the origins of necrophilia and how it progresses and how it gets to the point where it turns into a Jeffrey Dahmer. And as one of my famous science friends says, one of the great things about science is you're usually wrong. And so, as a researcher, you have to be very humble. And one of the ways to get famous is to prove your pro any other researchers wrong, right? So being wrong is a common thing as a scientist. And what I found was that, in fact, when I was doing the work that I did initially, that I was wrong once again, and that line is a lot more blurry between the fetish and actual acting out. And that was a shock to me. Admittedly, I was disappointed in myself. However, it took me 10 years from the first determination and the first hypothesis to where I'm at now. So luckily I had enough time to get myself ready without even realizing I was. And I discovered that through art, ironically enough, another thing I wasn't expecting, when I started looking into the erotic art of serial killers, those who have been incarcerated, and I found that the art that was created by kinksters and the art that was created by actual murderers wasn't all that dissimilar at all. So that line is a lot more blurry, which of course makes it more difficult for folks like me and may folks in law enforcement, like people who research these crimes in the FBI, to utilize some of the ways in which these folks who do act out the way they express themselves. It's really a matter of, it seems that way anyway, it's really a matter of not so much that they're on a trajectory to do it, because we don't know. It's really a matter of what that thing is that causes them to cross over into actually acting out. And that, I don't think anyone, even the most brilliant minds that are out there, can anticipate. And that's what folks like me are working towards. It's maybe, it's kind of like the question of the universe. What are its origins? Well, we don't know. That's okay not to know it because that gives us something to look for. And it allows us to stay in that mystery and to continue to obsess on that particular topic.
What texture makes me feel good? And I would say anything that's smooth and soft. It could be cotton, satin, silk. It could be polyester, as long as it feels really good against my skin. And that makes me so happy to have something that is cozy and yet sensual in some ways on my skin.
Want to anonymously be featured on our show? Then head to the link in our show notes to join our email list and get our Taboo Talks card game free. Inside, you'll find juicy taboo questions that turn vulnerability into connection. Play solo or with someone you trust, and maybe even share your truth on our show. Let's make it safe and sexy to talk about it all. See you there.
And so I got kicked back a notch because I was very sure of myself. Oh no, this over here and this over here, it's very black and white, and that's the way that it is. And I've had to humble myself and go, nope, it's a lot more gray than that. And the search continues.
Yeah, I mean, even as you're speaking about it, I'm like, God, I just want there to be a clear equation, right?
Yeah. Of
these three specific things lead someone to actually act on this fantasy. So then you can prevent it. So like, oh God, it's leaning into the darkness, right? Even more so, like leaning into the not knowing of like, you know, maybe one day we'll figure it out. But until then, we have to be comfortable on the edge of nothingness. And that's like, oh, it's
exactly. That's a great summary. That is really great. Yeah.
I really hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to hear more about studying the erotic art of the serial killers. Sure. And what you found, if any correlations, or just what you found in the erotic art that serial killers created, and why, and a little bit about why you're sharing that art now.
One of the things that I was very interested to find as I was reviewing and sort of analyzing these different erotic art pieces is that some of the most violent art comes from folks who can, doesn't necessarily always, but can come from someone who had a very troubled childhood and in a very dark place in their life when they were lost in a drug-fueled haze or what have you, a drug deal went bad. But they're not inherently a bad person. They were in a bad circumstance and acted out in a way that they normally wouldn't because they were influenced by the environment around them, the trauma they experienced, and also the influence of you know, illicit drugs or alcohol. But they do good work in prison, and there's advocacy to get them released early or to reduce their sentences and so forth because they've been a model prisoner while incarcerated. And then you have, for instance, Daniel Siebert. He's known as the American Angel of Death. He is one of the most heinous serial killers to walk the face of this planet. And his artwork, in contrast, he was a professional artist, depicts largely female empowerment and female on female love, lesbianism, and powerful queens and warriors and so forth. And yet, if you read his letters and you examine his crimes, it would be hard not to think that he absolutely despised women to his core. And yet yes. His art stands in complete and utter contrast to that. In fact, even the more adult, more explicit art that he did centered women and made men sort of just this appendage. A lot of times bodiless, headless appendages that focused largely on phalluses. It was very heteronormative, his art was. But it always centered female empowerment. And I found that to be so incredibly bizarre. So these are the contrasts, right? The other contrasts are some offenders like Issa Sagawa, who is a cannibal. His artwork absolutely described everything he ended up doing. And he started doing that kind of art when he was a child. Okay. And there was no varying between what he actually acted out on and how he depicted it in his art. And then there are those who either produced no art or indistinct art or scribbles. who ended up going on, like Ted Bundy, for instance, or even Richard Ramirez. Richard Ramirez produced art that really wasn't all that explicit. It was largely line art, and yet he was a total berserker in his crimes. So it's these contrasts that I found really interesting. There's, again, I come back to, there's no black and white. There's so many different shades of gray in the art that's produced by these individuals. And then, of course, you contrast that again with those who have never acted out at all. It's just a fantasy for them. And some of that art can be incredibly graphic, incredibly violent, and yet they are mothers and fathers, they have children, they have families, they're grandparents, they're working professionals, they're clergy, and doctors, lawyers, etc. They are in the helping professions. They could be advocates for others, activists on behalf of others, whether it's gender, sex, or class. So it's interesting what comes out of a good example. I'm working with an artist right now. His name is Curb Crawler Ghost. He's featured in the museum. He has an entire gallery. His artwork combines sexual violence and religion, in most cases, not all. I've been working with him now for a year, and he's been here visiting and doing live painting at the museum for the last 3 weeks. I've spent a lot of time with him. He is the most loving, soft-spoken, and devoted husband and father. Him and his wife have been together for over 15 years. They have an 11 and 14-year-old. He is crazy in love with his partner, and he is just the sweetest, softest, gentlest person you'd meet. So again, with the contrasts, right?
So deeply fascinating because
Wow.
my mind always is drawn towards patterns, right? I'm like, oh, this has happened this many times. This makes it like an absolute thing, right? I've always kind of had a scientific mind and been hypothesizing about things. But what you just shared, just I had full body chills and it felt like a bit of an awakening, right? Like where we try to put something in a box, but there really was never a box to begin with. And like, so yeah, it's so interesting. And I mean, I would love to know while you're spending time with this work, which can be really explicit and intense, right? Like the majority of people aren't directly in touch with with this type of content. And I just was wondering on a personal level, like with disturbing and unsettling content, like how do you stay grounded emotionally and like continuing to connect to the purpose of your work when you're exposed to such sometimes intense and graphic images?
Right. That's a really good question. I was recently asked that by someone who follows me on Instagram that I know locally. The answer is I don't know. I can tell you that in my career that I have been exposed to other kinds of material. That here in the United States and largely around the world is illegal. And that was part of my studies because I was training as a forensic sexologist and I was going to be doing court testimonies. I found that the work that I do now, I don't have a reaction to it. It's a it's I see it as a path towards understanding, as well as trying to provide tools for those who can give comfort as well as justice to those who are victims, like law enforcement. The more tools I can give them, the better. But this other work, and like I said, as a forensic sexologist, I've been exposed to a number of things while I was in academics actively, and I was doing my doctoral work that absolutely destroyed me. I barely got through the semester and had to, I don't know if you call it announcing, but had to share with professional colleagues that there was a certain kind of material that I was completely incapable of working with. It had extremely detrimental effects on my mental health. However, I have met people who, because of their trauma and their past when they were little, are competent working with offenders of that nature and can handle it and have steeled themselves in some way or compartmentalized. I couldn't. The work that I do, however, I suppose that's work that I have to continue to do on my own to figure out why I can seemingly tolerate this kind of content and have it not have the same effect on me as that other material did. So I've experienced the difference between the two, and I don't react the same way to this content as I did to the other kind of content. I leave that to the professionals that can handle that kind of content and do so in their law enforcement work or what have you. So
Wow. Yeah, I'm
although
wondering
I would
like
have to say that there is a little bit of maybe because I'm goth, there is a little bit of preparation or a comfort with death. So maybe there's that. When I was growing up, there were in Germany, there's a lot of really big graveyards, and I used to go visit a lot of family. So maybe to make light of it, I suppose perhaps I just have always been really comfortable with death because I've been surrounded by it growing up.
This is so fascinating. I'm wondering because it says in your bio that you and have investigated the effect of violence on the human psyche and the mind. And yeah, I'm curious, like, what have you found in that investigation? And what have you incorporated into your own life, maybe to allow you to investigate things that might feel really hard for other people to do?
So I did a lot of research on the dark web around violent adult content. Okay. And again, I was brought to these online communities where they traded in this content. It was self-created either through drawing or filming or what have you, and that was traded there before it became commercialized. And there are commercial, there are actually still spaces online where this kind of stuff is sold. So what we know so far, because there are other researchers that investigate adult content and violent adult content, which are two different things. However, the lines have gotten blurred recently with the narratives around sex trafficking and this idea that all sex work is trafficking, whereas if you talk to sex workers, no, it's not. It's not all trafficking. So the same kind of challenges are popping up in research, and folks like myself and other researchers are often in disagreement as to the effect that violent adult content has on individuals. And there seems to be, if there is any consensus, and I'm using that word very lightly because there's still very vibrant arguments amongst various scholars. But I think there is this notion amongst us that violent material is going to affect you negatively if you're predisposed to being affected negatively by violent material. Okay, it's the same kind of thing as if you have shame around self-pleasure, then seeing material of people self-pleasuring is going to cause you shame. And that same kind of linear, that same kind of path we're finding with violent content. Now, that doesn't necessarily exclude youth. There seems to be some indication that violent adult content, if youth are exposed to it, shapes how they interact sexually as they get older. Okay, and that's a cause for concern, even with scholars like me who tend to be a little bit more liberally minded when it comes to violent adult content. However, It does seem to affect youth negatively, and that's something that needs to be dealt with. And that can be dealt with through age-appropriate sex education and pornography literacy material and classes and so forth. However, as for adults, it's very mixed. There's no black and white. If you're going to be negatively affected by it or impacted by it, you're coming to it already susceptible. And if you're not, you're not, if that makes sense. So that's where we are right now with the research. We'll see where we continue to go with that research and whether or not we can ask more direct questions. Some of the problems that I have with some of the research that's being done is the way in which researchers are conducting their research tend to overlook leading questions. So, in other words, I saw one research project by a scholar coming from the McKinsey Institute, which phrased a question in such a way that made it sound like consensual spanking was abuse. BDSM and certain practices in BDSM was the way that the question was structured, as it sounded like it was abusive. And if you're phrasing your questions in such a way that leads a person to answer, oh, yes, that was abuse, then you're not really getting unbiased responses. So I think as researchers, we need to do better in how we ask questions to begin with so that they truly are neutral.
This is fascinating. I feel like what I'm hearing is that it's
What
like
I'm
a
hearing
previous
is it's like a previous.
thing. So maybe someone who has had a negative, or like, sorry, someone who has had a violent upbringing in some way, shape, or form might be more negatively affected by violent content than someone who grew up in a really safe home. Is that correct? Is that kind of
That's
like the
one, yeah,
general?
that's one possibility,
That's one
yes.
possible way. And I'm also curious with my own childhood, because I was so into murder mysteries when I was in elementary school. I was watching, Unsolved Mysteries. That was my favorite show, and all these murder mysteries where they would find children in garbage cans. And I don't know, I would eat that shit up when I was like 5, 6, 8 years old. And my parents, I remember, would be like, "Why are you watching this?" And in my mind, I'm like, well, it didn't make sense to me. Like, I grew up Christian. I grew up really watching Disney movies and all these other things. And I recently found out, like, as an adult, that I had like a repressed sexual violation that happened to me when I was really, really young. And so now I'm like putting these pieces together of like, oh, maybe that's why I was like so drawn to it, because it helped me to like understand my own situation and my own life story more.
Right. That's not an uncommon story, and thank you for sharing that. I would share that my daughter, now she was my stepdaughter, so she came into my life when she was 8, and but she's my daughter now. She could not get enough of horror movies and true crime and so forth and so on. And now she is a very skilled and sought after emergency room nurse. And she plans on continuing her education and becoming a coroner. So, isn't it interesting, the paths we take depending on what we're interested in? And I don't know that we've really figured out why some of us are more fascinated by death, other than, and I'm trying to remember the author's name. Erwin Yalom, actually, he's on my bookshelf. Erwin Yalom is his expertise was in counseling science, and I loved his work when I was doing my undergrad. And he wrote a book called Staring at the Sun, and it talks about how people react to death, whether it's their own impending death or death that's around them, and how they cope with it and how it speaks to us existentially. I highly recommend reading Staring into the Sun by Erwin Yalom. He dives into that much more deeply than I have, and why we tend to be fascinated by death, which is sometimes intricately linked to sexuality and eroticism. Sex and death.
I have one more question for you before we wrap up this section, and that's like this idea of going into the shadow and like the amount that you're able to go into the shadow equaling the amount that you're able to like actually come into conscious light and like on the other side of that. And I'm just curious from your own life experience, your research, your whole dharma, like how has integrating your darkness allowed you to actually be more embodied in your light and in your wholeness?
It's allowed me to come to a point of self-acceptance that, interestingly enough, I find is frightening to those around me, which is really weird for me because I get to live a shame-free life, and that is an uncommon experience for people. It doesn't uncouple me from accountability. I don't have to indulge my own dark side and abandon being accountable to those around me. Are there mistakes that are sometimes made? Yes. But because there's a lack of shame, like, and I didn't grow up with shame, I don't understand the notion of shame. And I think that's because I was taught, and I attribute that to my mom and to my German upbringing. Because there's so much self-acceptance around sexuality and the culture I grew up in, and also the home I grew up in, that the only thing that could take that to the place of shame would be accountability. So I can own my own dark truth, and I can be honest about it with those who want to walk in that space with me and take accountability when I mess up. I would end that comment with, I wish I could find more people that I would want to walk that path with who also approach their dark side from that perspective. And that's been very hard to find.
Yeah, how sensitive that is, and how beautiful and liberating it has been for you to fully embrace your shadow and live this shameless life. And I'm curious for like people listening, and even from my selfish perspective, like if I'm going to go deeper into my shadow and embrace these parts of myself, like what would you say to me and those people? Like, if you would say like, if it's not there, build it, right? Like if you want this like like the shadow army of people that are daringly jump into the darkness with you. Gloria, let's go. Like, what would you say might be like a first step for people that are resisting it, repressing it, avoiding it, scared of it? Like, is it safe down there? Like, what would you say to those people?
Is it safe? Nope, it's not, because you're going to look at parts of yourself that might be ugly or angry or dangerous. Though you can't have that without, you can't have the light parts of yourself. You can't have the parts of yourself that love others, who accept others, who are accountable to others, unless you're willing to look in the mirror in the darkest parts of your inner workings. So now I'm not necessarily including those who, well, yeah, I am, because if you can't be accountable to others, then there's a problem, right? So is it safe there? No. However, if we avoid those parts of ourselves, we can't free ourselves from the chains that exist there. We can't find real personal freedom unless we are willing to accept every side of ourselves, including the dark side. I know I'm sounding like Star Wars right now, but it is what it is. So the first step would be examine the influences that you grew up with. What parts of your upbringing taught you to be ashamed of who you are? And I'm not talking about the side of yourself that could harm others. I'm not going to exempt that side, okay? Because we're all capable of that, and that needs to be, I don't want to say restrained, but we can have this journey and not harm others or ourselves. We're gonna be looking at parts of ourselves that are scary, but we don't have to hurt ourselves or others in that process. So where were you taught shame? Was it your family of origin? Was it the religion you grew up in? Where were you taught that? That's where I would start. So, for instance, if you struggle with self-pleasure, what were you taught as a child or growing up that led you to that conclusion that self-pleasure is something to be ashamed of? Let's start there. And then you can take step by step by step further down that road.
Beautiful, exquisite. I love the way that you package that so beautifully and clearly.
Thanks.
Yeah, it really is all direct reflection. The mirror that we hold to ourselves is the extent which we can hold that with anyone else in our lives, the extent of intimacy, connection, authenticity we can show up with in the world. Yeah, so we're going to take one more short little break and then we'll be back and wrap up of this juicy episode with Victoria.
Listen up. I have to let you in on the most revolutionary pleasure program I've ever experienced. I'm completely obsessed. The Vita Coaching Certification is one of the most advanced trainings on the planet for sex, love, and relationship coaches, and it's completely transformed my life. It's not just a coaching program, it's a dream erotic education, fusing tantra, neuroscience, IFS, and somatics full of embodied, juicy pleasure practices. I've shed layers of sexual trauma, religious shame, and toxic patterns. My nervous system is regulating, my pleasure is awakening, and my relationships are thriving. I feel more alive than ever. You become the embodied transmission, walking the path you'll guide your clients through. Plus, the business training sets you up for success. I already have my first client and I'm only halfway through. The support is unmatched. The sisterhood is global. And even though it's online, it feels deeply personal. So if you feel the call to transform your life and rise as a coach that this world desperately needs, click the link and say yes.
Welcome back. Thank you for tuning into today's episode. And Victoria, it has been incredibly powerful diving deep into your work and ultimately shadow. Before we wrap, I am curious, through all of your life's work and shadow studies, what wisdom would you like to leave our listeners with and ultimately the world?
To make space for one another from a place of acceptance while also holding each other accountable if we engage in a way that harms. That's it.
Short, sweet, and
Making
dirt.
it, making, creating space for others to feel accepted can be incredibly powerful, and most of the time that just looks like being quiet and listening.
Yeah, just that the beauty of saying like all of you is safe with me, like all the parts that you've been told can't be here, or you have to hide or put under the table, like they're cool with me, like I'm here to hold them. There's so much power in that. Thank you for sharing that. It's really beautiful and a fantastic message.
Yeah, this has been such an incredible conversation. We want to know what you're currently working on, what you're currently excited about, and we'll link all this in the show notes so everyone listening can read your books and connect with you. But yeah, if you want to just leave listeners with a little bit of what you're up to now.
What we're doing, so of course I'm the director of the Erotic Heritage Museum, and in total of my time there,
I didn't do that.
Did you want me to start from the beginning?
I accidentally
Heather?
hit, but we're recording, so we can just edit this part
Okay,
out.
just edit it. Okay. I'm the director of the Erotic Heritage Museum here in Vegas. I've been the director since 2014, and I started there in 09 actually as a student. That was a satellite campus for the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. It was in San Francisco where I went to graduate school. And right now it's a slow time in Vegas. It's been slower, but it's slower than normal. So when we have slow times at the museum, we take advantage of the opportunity that we have having the interior of the museum be so quiet to build and expand and modernize and update. And right now what we're doing is we're actually modernizing our retail space. So that's been cool. So we could better feature prints that artists have brought to us for sale. Of course, we have original pieces inside the museum that are also for sale, but a lot of people can't spend that kind of money. We're expanding on the print area where people can take home some of the artwork that's much more affordable, as well as our swag and our clothing. We have a whole clothing line, which I wear all the time. So there's that. And I just love doing interior stuff in the museum and making it more modern. It's a little bit old school, but we like to add some modern elements. And then for research or writing, I'm writing the follow-up to my book that I just published last August, so about a year ago, the Sexual Art of Serial Killers. I'm writing the second follow-up to this. So this is volume one, and I'm writing volume two. I'm part of a I'm the co-researcher for an investigative project with Dr. David Wall that I really wish I could talk about, but can't. But it's probably one of it is I would say it's going to be the most subversive field research I've done. So it's not just purely academic. I will be going to sites to investigate this phenomenon. And like I said on my podcast, I don't know. I think I should be more afraid, but I'm not, and maybe I should be. So if I survive it, and I'm not trying to like titillate or anything like that, there is genuine danger involved. So I if it all goes well, then there'll be a research paper coming out of that. And he's one of the very few that travels these roads like me and takes these kind of risks. So I have huge respect for him. And actually doing this research with him, I feel safe. So if we're going to go into this danger, we're going to do it together, and that's pretty cool. And then the third one is just happened. I mentioned earlier that I'm working with an artist by the name of Curb Crawler Ghost. He's an incredibly subversive artist out of Chile, and he's here in Vegas right now visiting. And he invited me to create an art book that we are now in the process. We just actually did a photo shoot to do sort of like teasers for this book. And what we are blending is an analysis from me of certain serial killers and his interpretation of the crime through his art. So it's going to be either bound in velour or bound in leather, and it's almost going to be a book of poetry and song and art, and yet it's all going to be centered around an intimate look, or yeah, an analysis, but also an intimate look. So through the eyes of the killer or through the eyes of the offender, and what that might look like to them. But it's also going to have a very artsy, poetic vibe to it. So we just had a meeting yesterday about what direction we want to take, and I'm sure that's going to change and evolve as we go along. But it's going to be a tabletop art book, and I'm excited to see the end result. I don't really know where it's going, but I love being in mystery. So all of these things are very mysterious and unknown, and I live for that kind of stuff. So most of the time, I also like my structure. So I like balance. I love balance. Let's have some structure and a foundation to spring from, and then the rest of it can be mystery. And that's kind of how I live my life. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Love that. Love that.
So very
Yeah,
balanced.
that's great. You're so accomplished. You're doing so many things, three books, an erotic museum, a podcast. Look at you. Wow. So, yeah, thank you so much for joining us. This episode has, yeah, it's opened up so many doors in my psyche and my subconscious. I feel like there's probably more that's going to come through after the show is
Definitely
over. Just like
aftercare is important.
letting it sink in. Yeah, aftercare, balancing. And I wanted to end the show in a fun way. So please, if you feel available, make one sound to describe how you're feeling after this conversation.
Squee.
Yay.
That's my
Amazing.
sound.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning into Taboo Talks, where some truths need to be spoken and some silences need to be broken. Each week, we come together with diverse minds to explore and integrate the dance between shadow and light. Join our community and stay connected to all of the exciting movements of our mission through our website at cissociety.world, where you can sign up for our email list. This is the best way to stay updated on new taboo topics, episodes of our podcast, and even find live events near you. On our website, you'll also find links to follow our podcast, Taboo Talks, on platforms like Spotify, YouTube, and Apple. For those who want to dive even deeper, you can join our private WhatsApp community to engage in meaningful discussions about taboo topics with members from all over the world. So don't miss a moment. Visit cissociety.world and share these conversations to support the expansion of our mission. Together, we can spark the change the world needs. Until next time, stay curious, stay open, and remember, the only thing taboo is not talking about it.